Welcome, everyone. This is David Greenwalt with Leanness Lifestyle University, and today I'm very excited to be interviewing a published researcher in the field of diet, exercise, and fitness, Professor James Clark. James, welcome to the call, and thank you for doing the interview.
Thank you for having me, David.
Would you please tell my listeners a little bit about your educational background and what your current position is?
Sure. Currently, I'm an adjunct professor at Manchester Community College while I'm in the process of applying for full-time tenure-track positions. I have an educational background in physiology from Loyola Marymount University. I have graduate education in physical therapy from University of Miami in Florida, integrative and evolutionary biology from the University of Southern California, and exercise physiology from the University of Connecticut. I've been doing sports medicine and allied health in various roles for about 18 years now, beyond just the professorship and the research.
You've made quite the rounds to the universities.
Yeah, the joke in my family is that I'm a professional student.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, I certainly enjoyed the article, and what drew me to you is an article that you had published in the Journal of Diabetes and Metabolic Disorders titled, it's a long title, everyone, but bear with me. It's a cool one because I think it just is such a direct hit for what we care about. Titled, Diet, Exercise, or Diet with Exercise, Comparing the Effectiveness of Treatment Options for Weight Loss and Changes in Fitness for Adults 18 to 65 Years Old Who Are Overfat or Obese, a Systematic Review and Meta-Analysis. When I saw that title, I thought, boy, that's a direct hit for what we care about. So we're going to definitely get into that in just a couple of minutes here. But let me ask you first, what drew your interest to studying the impact of diet and exercise on weight management?
Well, it actually didn't stem directly to weight management. It was mainly looking at the interest really lied in diabetic changes more
sure.
than in weight management. I'm a former athlete, and I spent many years working as an athletic trainer and a strength coach where I had many diabetic athletes where we had to change up how we could train them. And so part of the interest that I had lied in that. The other part of my interest was not directly in weight management and with exercise, but it was looking at the changes in hormones based off of the use of dietary supplements in combination with exercise and diet, not just for weight management, but for general health purposes. Because there's a lot of misconceptions and misnomers out there about what people who have weight issues should and shouldn't be doing. And a lot of it is based off of biases that many professionals have, as well as many researchers have. And it kind of stymied a lot of what we know can work and what we actually apply in practice. And that's kind of what led to a lot of the meta-analysis papers and systematic review papers that I've been putting out in the last couple of years.
I absolutely agree. You know, when I read a paper that will tout the amazing benefits, which there are, of, you know, cardiorespiratory exercise, endurance training, and so forth as the king, the end all, the be all, the superior, and then you look at the backgrounds of the researchers involved, and they're endurance athletes,
mm-hmm.
or they were former endurance athletes. And for any human being to say that, you know, I realize it's science, I realize it's peer reviewed, I realize it's published, but for any human being to look at that and say that there's no influence and bias, they're just fooling themselves.
Well, it's not just in terms of that bias. There's a bias towards level of training intensities due to acute metabolic changes, which recently has been labeled as lipomax, which is the basic percentage of heart rate or the percentage of aerobic capacity that the individual is working at relative to acute lipid oxidation or use of fats for fuel sources. And the problem is that a lot of the research has been focused on what's acutely occurring without any impact on what's the chronic or what's the long-term impact to that one acute episode. And so a lot of the research that you see, even if you ignore the background of the individual. A lot of it is based off of the, I don't want to call it the bad conception, but the conception that what you have to do is utilize aerobic or endurance style activities to induce body compositional changes. When what we're now seeing is that it's not about that acute episode, it's about the chronic exposure.
Yeah, thank you for that. And what came to mind as you were talking about that is, for so long, and I think this is part of what you were touching on there, is researchers or whoever would say, what type of exercise, what intensity, what duration, what style, whatever, is going to induce during the exercise the greatest utilization of, you know, of stored fat.
Correct.
Whereas that may not in the end translate into the greatest results overall. And, you know, correct me if I'm wrong, but, you know, in so many instances, you know, if we burn, you know, if our primary fuel source is fat during a workout, then we'll utilize carbohydrates, you know, as an energy source later. Or if our primary fuel source during a workout is glycogen carbohydrate, then we're going to utilize fat as an energy source later. And the energy substrate actually used during the exercise session is just not as important as some of these other things that we're going to talk about today.
That's part of the equation there. The other part of the equation is understanding that most of the time when we're at rest, if we're in a normal, healthy status, the principal source of fuel that the body is going to be utilizing is going to be lipids regardless of anything else.
Right.
Because the fuel source that the body is going to utilize is going to be dependent upon the rate that the cells have to regenerate the ATP, the actual energy molecule that the cells use to provide for work. How quickly does the cell have to regenerate that is going to dictate what type of fuel source it can use. And so, like, the principal fuel source that you and I are using right now, just talking, and the principal source of people who are listening to this is going to be lipids if they're in a healthy, if their health status state is correct, which means that they don't have a large immune response or a chronic immune response, that people who have large amounts of lipid depositing, who are over fat, will have. So people who just sitting here just normally chatting about will principally be utilizing lipids. Now, the other thing that's going to go into that equation is what type of fuel sources are we putting into our body? And that's where we got, in terms of the nutrition aspect, we kind of got sidetracked for a long period of time with the concept of the low-fat diet, where if you look at a lot of the research that's coming out more recently looking at the ketotic diets, particularly the high-fat diet, it seems to have benefit for, in terms of metabolism, for fuel utilization in both the exercise mode as well as in the rest and recovery mode.
Well, what I love about all of this is that, you know, I'm going to ask this question next. We're going to get into your actual published article.
Mm-hmm.
But what I like is that, you know, you're looking at this not from a, you know, what do we think? What does the common person on the street, what does the media, what does the person who cannot think for themselves and only regurgitates, you know, what they've heard most recently, instead of looking at that and saying, you know, this is where we are, you looked at this and said, wait a minute, what does the data really say about the nutritional composition versus exercise? And this exercise intensity versus another exercise intensity, this exercise modality versus another exercise modality. And you know, you mentioned it before, and we'll probably talk a little bit about it in a few minutes, but you look at the whole hormonal response to both the inputs of nutrition and the inputs of exercise type and intensity. And, you know, I think, as you say, it's quite complex. It's not as simple as energy in, energy out.
That's very true. And in fact, in a different paper that was just a general review of the issues of fitness and fatness, the whole concept of being fit versus being fat and the way in which we talk about it is we talk about it being an extremely linear process. Step A goes to step B goes to step C. But in actuality, it's like 5,000 cogs within a machine all spinning at the same time and trying to pinpoint which cog is causing the issues is very hard to pinpoint. And that's one of the limitations that we have within the scientific experimentation here is that what we see on the cellular level doesn't always transfer to the tissue level and doesn't always transfer to the organism. And then the different organisms that we use to study don't always transfer directly to each other. So a lot of the animal studies that we have don't necessarily show the same thing when we look at it with humans.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. Just far more complex than, you know, the calories in, calories out, you know, model. And, you know, I always looked at, and I still do, I look at nutrition or food as information, and the body has to decode it and what it does with that and the impact and the whole downstream impact of hormones and the various metabolites and what happens then and then what happens and then what happens is far more complex than just saying, well, you know, I don't know, a calorie is a calorie. Just get in X number of calories and you should be able to perform in X way and you should weigh a certain amount. And it just does not translate that way.
And that's very true. And that's why the way in which I approach it, the way in which when I talk about it, is I don't talk about it in terms of the calorie in, calorie out balance.
Yeah.
I talk about it in terms of the fitness fatness balance, because
mm-hmm.
it's about health status as opposed to energetic balance.
Let me ask you this, and this is an offshoot a little bit, but I think it's directly related to what you're talking about, the whole fitness fatness.
Mm-hmm.
In your give us as best you can your layman's expert opinion on at what level of fatness can we still be fit? Is there a point where you just can say, you know what, I'm a, you know, let's take a CrossFit type athlete, you know, someone who can do overhead squats and they can do incredible metabolic challenging things and they can move in a variety of planes and they've got a certain level of aerobic function and anaerobic function and muscular strength and muscular endurance and flexibility and on and on, the standard fitness parameters. But is there a point where you're too fat to be considered fit, or what's your position on that?
It's more of a continuum between the fatness and the fitness issues. And it's about looking at the balance between the fitness hormonal signals versus the fatness hormonal signals. And when I say fatness hormonal signals, I'm basically talking about the innate immunological signals from the immune system that trigger inflammation. Because as we become more sedentary and as we increase the general level of fatness, and it's not subcutaneous or ornamental fatness, it's fatness within what's called the viscera, the fatness around the abdominal cavity, and in particular below the skin abdominal cavity, that is going to cause a lot of the fatness signals. And those fatness signals lead to changes in health. And even if we say, okay, we'll look at the CrossFit athlete, to use your example. The CrossFit athlete may be able to do everything you just mentioned, but they may have the same immunological signals as someone who is highly sedentary because of the stress that the CrossFit exercise puts on the body. And if they don't follow correct regimen for recovery periods and they don't follow correct regimen of periodization within their training, they can be as unhealthy as someone who sits on the couch all day. Even if we look at them and say, oh, they can do this, oh, they can do that, because the fitness and the fatness issues develop into an overall continuum that is not necessarily measurable strictly by looking at what the person can do. It's more about looking at what are the hormonal levels that they have, and in particular, what's the difference, what is the comparison between the hormones that cause inflammation versus the hormones that limit inflammation.
If I'm hearing you correctly too, there's a big emphasis on inflammation.
Correct. Because most of the issues that we see coming out in terms of diseases that come from excess fat is not because of the fat per se, but because of inflammation that the body receives in terms of signals from cells that are associated with the fat.
Sure. Yeah. No. In total agreement here. I mean, anything I've read, you know, everything from very early work to Dr. Barry Sears to you name it. I mean, inflammation is so incredibly powerful and important, and it's underconsidered by, you know, most people and even researchers.
Correct. And the biggest problem with the person who has the weight management issue, in particular, the person who is what's usually referred to as being either metabolically obese or what I like to refer to as being over fat. They have what I like to call anabolic dysregulation. And so what ends up happening is that their anabolic hormones, the hormones that cause lean muscle tissue to grow, is blocked. And it's blocked because of the amount of inflammation that they have going coursing through their bodies. And all of those inflammatory signals, all that inflammation, is what leads to all of the cardiovascular issues that they have, all of the metabolic issues that they have. And if you can limit that amount of inflammation, you can minimize the impact of the fatness. And this is one of the things that wasn't in the article that we're going to talk about, but in a later article that basically indicates that a lot of the body weight changes that we'd like to measure are nothing more than cheerleader effects on the overall change in the person's health.
Did you say cheerleader effects?
A cheerleader effect. It's so when we talk about effects, there's different types of effects. There's therapeutic effects, things that change your overall health. There are clinical effects that change the way in which you function. And then there's what we tend to call cheerleading effects. These are effects that change your psychological adherence to a therapeutic involvement. So a lot of the changes that we'd like to track, particularly in weight management issues, tend to be more of a cheerleading effect, an effect that says, "Hey, congratulations, you did this." Or I psychologically see a change in my morphology, so I'm going to keep working at what I'm doing. Whereas it doesn't actually have a true therapeutic benefit by itself.
Can you give an example, like a boots on the ground, real world example that my listeners might be able to kind of wrap their head around with what you're talking about there, a cheerleader effect that really isn't all that good for therapeutic or clinical outcome?
Well, so we like to look at the scale a lot. But the problem is that all the scale is measuring is poundage. It's not measuring where that pound in terms of body mass is made up of.
Right.
And so if you look at all of the mass market shows that are out there, they always want to put the person on the scale. And they either are, "Hey, congratulations, you lost so many pounds," or, "Hey, you didn't meet your pound goal." And so what that becomes is that becomes the psychological adherence factor or the cheerleader to the benefit, where you're not really figuring out, okay, I didn't lose any. So example, I lost 0 poundage this week, even though my goal was 5 pounds of loss. But what the scale doesn't tell me is that I had 0 pounds of loss, but I lost 5 pounds of muscle, which is 5 pounds of fat, and gained 5 pounds of muscle. So the net benefit was 0, but the health benefit was great because I lost the mass that will trigger inflammation, and I gained mass that will limit inflammation.
When we look at that, absolutely right. You know, the scale does not tell us whether we lost fat, water, muscle, gained water, fat, muscle. Doesn't tell us that specifically. What is your opinion on the ability, you know, of an individual? Let me ask you this. What is your opinion overall from a weight management perspective on utilizing the scale as a tool?
And this goes into the later paper I was just referencing. the scale should not be used as a tool for gauge until training has been continuous for about 6.5 weeks. And then it should be utilized as a gauge strictly for mass, not necessarily in terms of a cost benefit analysis, but strictly to track mass change. There are much better tools out there to track morphological changes than the scale.
Like what?
And waist hip ratio.
So use a tape measure.
Yep, the girth measurement and the ratio between the waist and the hip is much more benefit in terms of a health status analysis than the scale.
Is your belief for the average person doing the average types of workouts that they're going to put on substantial muscle in a 1 week, 4 week, 8 week, 12 week period?
Depends on what their training status happened to be before they started the training. Most mass gains do not take place until you're about 8 weeks into training. During that first 8 week period of time, you'll see performance benefits from exercise training, but most of that performance benefit is happening either in the nervous system, where you're learning how to recruit all of the muscles better and you basically become more efficient at what you're doing, or it's happening within the cells of the body, where the cells of the body are metabolizing stuff more efficiently.
Absolutely. So early on, let's take that same person. Let's take the person who's just starting. So early on, they came from the couch. They've been on the couch for 2 years, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And they're, 40, 50 years old, and they really haven't exercised regularly for quite some time. But they've been essentially a desk job, a couch person for, the last couple of years. So they haven't done much. They're going to start some type of blended, cardio and resistance training. And for the first 8 weeks, we're going to keep them off the scale, but they're really not going to put on much muscle because it's more neurologically oriented. What is the weight they lose going to be in the first 8 weeks?
In the first 8 weeks, in that scenario, most of the mass that they would have lost should be in the form of fat mass, as long as they have proper recovery in between their training sessions.
Okay, cool. Yeah, it's I would agree.
And when I'm talking about proper recovery, it's not just duration time; it's nutrition as well. Because the person that goes from that sedentary state to the exercise state, if they don't have a proper nutritional component to that, and in this case here, we're looking at an increase of protein more than anything within their diet to offset any type of protein loss that might have occurred during the exercise.
And during the first 8 weeks, if we're going to keep them off the scale, you're saying that it would be a more accurate measure of their progress on a day-to-day or a weekly basis if they put a tape around their waist and hips versus the scale.
And even then, I wouldn't do it a day-to-day.
So every week, every 2 weeks.
I would do in between 1 week and 2 weeks, in terms of a time frame. But during that first 8 weeks, most of the goals and most of what they should be tracking should not be morphological in nature, but should be performance in nature.
Is your feeling then that the early on morphological measurements are not important enough to give feedback so that changes along the way can be made? Because I have found more times than not that little changes are going to need to be made along the way, because the most people who have a weight issue, whether they're over fat or obese, don't always have and aren't always, which has nothing to do with intelligence or ability or anything else. Every one of my clients I've ever worked with has been intelligent, very well equipped to handle, you know, so many other or all parts of life, and they're great people. So it didn't have anything to do with that. But I have found in, you know, 30 years of doing this that people aren't always the best at gauging what their real performance is. And if they're really looking at saying, you ask that person, say, have you improved your nutrition? Yes, I have. You know, are you, you know, have you improved your protein intake? And are you eating more fruits and vegetables or whatever the path is? Yes, I have. And have you reduced your intake? Do you feel like you have? Yes. Are you following 3 to 4, 5, 6 meals, whatever it is? Yes, I have. And how's your exercise? It's very good. I'm walking on the treadmill and I'm doing some resistance training and all that.
That's a very good point. But when I'm talking about performance, I'm actually talking about at what intensity was I walking on the treadmill? So what was the speed of the treadmill? What was the incline of the treadmill? What was my heart rate at the beginning and at the end? So if I start off lifting at a 5-pound dumbbell, I'm now at a 25-pound dumbbell. And so during that first 8 weeks, it's not a subjective rating, just like the scale is not a subjective rating. It's an objective thing. And so a lot of times, and this goes to an argument that I have with a lot of people, is that we like to talk about physical activity as being exercise because we tell people to go do stuff, and that's physical activity. When we talk about exercise, we're talking about having something that's regimented, something that we actually track, something that we actually change, and something that we will modulate the intensity in order to have an outcome goal. And so a lot of times what happens is that, like, you go, and I, like I said, I've had this debate with a number of my friends who are MDs and DOs, where, well, I tell the person to go do this, and I say, yeah, but that's great, but if all they're doing is that and they don't know, okay, am I working at a good enough intensity to cause changes, it's not gonna mean anything. And that's where when we talk about looking at the performance gains, it's actually, okay, so on day one, I was only able to walk continuously at 3 miles an hour on the treadmill for 5 minutes. At week two, I'm now doing it for 20 minutes.
Yeah, absolutely. And if I'm hearing you correctly, the performance measures are, which I love, we teach that as well. And it's, you know, I recommend heart rate monitors. I recommend making sure that they've got details and feedback and can really look at the performance measure so that they can improve it. Because if we don't measure it, we can't improve it.
Correct.
It's very difficult to improve it or difficult to know if you're improving it. But if I'm hearing you correctly, too, you're suggesting early on that they, you know, they do really look at the details. They do look at the performance measures, but not only of the exercise, whether it's weights they're using, how many reps they did, blah, 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 how much tonnage they moved in X period of time, how fast they walked on the treadmill. But I suspect what you also want them to do early on is just as meticulously, with just as much feedback, to monitor with detail and precision their nutrition.
Correct.
So, yeah, and we also promote that and love that. And it's absolutely, those are two huge, huge factors, you know, that we promote, is having the information, utilizing the information, looking for incremental improvement all along the way. So I'm not surprised that you have people that argue with you on that, but I'll tell you, you aren't going to get any argument from me on it. I'm in total agreement with utilizing the data, utilizing the feedback, and making sure that you're not just saying, I went for a walk. Well, good, right? It's good. You went for a walk. But if you're really wanting to make significant changes in your weight and health, fitness, or whatever, then knowing how far you walked, how fast.
Exactly. It's almost too, we like to, in the exercise science world, we like to think about the athlete side and then the general population side. But when it comes to training and to tracking training, it should be just one umbrella, because the way in which we track an athlete in terms of their performance should be the same way that we track anybody else in terms of their performance. And it's something where if you look at what's the athlete's intent in terms of their performance gain, and then what's the Joe the plumber's intent in terms of performance gain. And this is where a lot of people, because there's a lot of repetition and a lot of I tried, I failed. And a lot of that goes back to the fact that there are very, very poor goal setting methods for the people with weight management issues, or the people who are trying to change their fatness fitness balance.
Well, absolutely. It's unfortunately, the five-word diet, eat less and exercise more, is what is promoted the most.
Correct.
You know, and, eat less and exercise more.
And the problem is that if you look, and I was just on Yahoo this morning, you go in there and there's 8 million different eat less stories, and there's 5 million exercise more stories, and no one knows, okay, what's the best? Oh, this scientist said that. Oh, that scientist said that. And the problem is that a lot of the, and this leads into one of the questions we had about why do the meta-analysis, why do the systematic review?
Yeah.
Because what it does is it takes us away from the single study, and it takes us away from the selective population. What the systematic review and what the meta-analysis does is it gives us the greatest level of scientific strength in terms of our argument, because it gets away from the antidotes, and it gets us away from the single studies, and it allows us to get into what is the population at large looking at in terms of their responses. And what a lot of people don't understand is that everybody's going to respond somewhere along a normal curve. And the normal curve, for those who remember in school, the bell-shaped curve.
Sure.
The bell-shaped curve is the normal curve, and everybody doing any type of activity or any type of exercise or any type of diet is going to have a response that's somewhere along that normal curve. But what gets reported is the average, was that the peak within that normal curve. And that peak within the normal curve that is being reported upon may only exist for that one population that was studied. And so what the meta-analysis does and what the systematic review does is it allows us to take all of these various populations and clump them together so that we can look at the population at large in terms of a normal curve. And then the way in which this meta-analysis looked at is that we didn't look at the absolute measures. We looked at what's referred to as the effect size measure. Because when you look at the absolute measure, you end up having issues with differences in training intensities, differences in diet, differences in populations in terms of gender, in terms of socioeconomic conditions. But when you lump them all together and look at the effect size, what you're looking at is you're looking at not only what's the average, but then how does that population vary amongst itself? Where does everybody fall within a normal curve? And then how does one normal curve compare to a different normal curve? And that's where we started to parse through all of the various nutritional aspects and all the various exercise aspects that a person who's looking at weight management can possibly do.
Yeah, it's super, super interesting. And you're right. You know, one of my questions was going to be, what is a meta-analysis? And I think you gave just an excellent overview of what it is. And I love review articles. I love review articles. I love meta-analysis articles when I come across them, for all the reasons that you said it's collection.
Sure. Correct. And the best part about that is that the way in which we actually analyze on a meta-analytical level is different than the way in which we analyze on the intra-study method. On the intra-study method within a single study group, we tend to utilize a deductive pattern of reasoning where we're basically trying to fit our findings into some global theory. Whereas on the meta-analysis, we're basically following an inductive pattern in reasoning, which basically where we're following the data and then formulating this theory off of that data, formulating a new possible line of thought from the data, as opposed to trying to get our data to fit into a known line of thought.
That's interesting. Well, I'll segue right into that then. I think that is a good segue, because I'm going to ask you, before you analyzed all the data, did you have a theory or belief about what you'd find regarding diet or exercise, or diet and exercise on weight loss and fitness all that?
Sure. The hypothesis that we tested was that there was going to be no difference in effectiveness between any of the exercise methods, meaning that all exercise methods would be equal to each other. And then on the dietary hypothesis, we basically stipulated that the high protein diet would have the most benefit.
Okay, so starting off, you came into it with a theory that a higher protein diet would have a better effect overall than a lower protein diet, but when it came to the exercise, all exercise would come out to be equal.
Correct. Because when you do the meta-analysis, you basically have to start off with a hypothesis.
Okay.
And so you have to start off with a hypothesis before you start digging into what's going on. So the question that we were attempting to address was, what's the difference between all of these things? Because you go and talk to any researcher, you go and talk to any medical professional, there's 5 million different opinions out there. And so the question is, okay, what is the actual difference?
Okay. So let's get into that. So if we're looking at, the type of nutrition, and whether nutrition has a better impact alone, whether it's nutrition with exercise, whether it's exercise alone, and whether it's, nutrition with what type of exercise. I realize, you and I could be here for 3 hours, and we didn't even scratch the surface. But if we're kind of summarizing this, we know what your theory was going into it. What did you actually find?
Well, in terms of responsiveness, we'll start with that. If you look in the population on aggregate, on total, in terms of what you can expect about 67% of the population to have a beneficial response to resistance training, any level of resistance training.
What do you mean by beneficial effect?
Beneficial effect is a change in body composition that reduces fat mass while maintaining or elevating fat-free mass.
Okay, I like all that.
Beneficial changes also included changes in lipid profile, reduction of LDL, reduction of total cholesterol, reduction of triglycerides, and maintaining of high-density lipoproteins, HDL.
I like all that, too.
Elevation of aerobic fitness, which was measured here as a VO2 max.
Now I'm going to be a smart aleck and be devil's advocate. What? Wait a minute, James. Wait a minute now. You're talking about RT improving aerobic fitness. Come on.
Correct. It has to do with a very simple fact that anytime you do any type of movement, you have a cardiovascular response.
Mm-hmm.
And the theory here, and this is leading into another avenue of research, is that the benefit that resistance training provides is not just because of the movement, but because of the changes in inflammatory signals. The hormones that cause inflammation get reduced for resistance training. The other thing that happens with resistance training, and once again, this is a theory here, that doesn't happen with, I mean, this is a hypothesis here, that doesn't happen with endurance training, is that there's a transient hypertensive moment, a very short-lived high blood pressure moment that leads to increase of what's called arterial compliance. That's the ability for the arteries to expand and then return to normal size. And what that does is that leads to a reduced blood pressure in the person and leads to better cardiac function, better heart function. And the other thing that happens is that in the muscles is that there's a signal that is what's referred to as an ischemic signal that leads to an increase in mitochondria in the muscles. That signal occurs with both resistance training and with endurance training. But when you couple all of the other things that occur with resistance training that's not occurring with endurance training, that's where you get the benefit.
And correct me if I'm wrong here, but when I hear, you know, there's an ischemic effect affecting mitochondria, if I was to translate that the best I could, I think, to my audience, I would say that there is a short-term deficit of oxygen that improves the efficiency of the power plants of our cells.
Correct. So what happens is that because of the intensity that the muscle has to work at during resistance training, it doesn't have a chance to obtain as much oxygen as it would at a lower intensity or at a constant intensity. And so that causes the need for more of the mitochondria, more of the powerhouses for those muscle cells.
And I want to make sure that, because I just, you know, I've read your article a couple of times, and I just heard you say it again, but I think this is important. You can tell me if it's important or not. You talked about intensity, because you talked about,
correct,
you know, if the average person just goes, and let's just say that they're capable of, bear with me, curling 50 pounds for 10 repetitions, and on the 10th repetition, if you held a gun to their head, they could not curl that for 11. Let's say that's what they were capable of.
Mm-hmm.
But instead of curling 50 pounds, they curl a total of 10 pounds for 10 reps because they've been told to start a resistance training program, and they do that for 3 sets. That's not what we're talking about here, right?
No, that's not what we're talking about. There are different types of resistance training exercise, and what we found with the meta-analysis here is that the person who is looking at a weight reduction or a weight management issue, it should be focusing on what we generally refer to as hypertrophy level of resistance training, which would be about 75% to 80% of what you can do maximally. And you're looking at somewhere in the neighborhood of 6 to 10 repetitions of that in about 3 sets with somewhere in the neighborhood of 60 to 90 seconds of rest recovery in between the sets. And then in terms of the type of exercise, it's not doing like the bicep curl exercises. It's doing whole body exercises or large muscle group exercises, things like squats, deadlifts, bench press, lateral pull down, military press, rows, as opposed to doing the bicep curls and the tricep presses or the leg extensions and the leg curl type exercises.
Absolutely. Okay. Excellent distinction there. And I'm glad that you know, we kind of made sure that, because there is a lot of confusion over what is resistance training.
Correct.
You know, I mean,
and that's where, and just to get back to the population issue, while 67% will see a benefit from resistance training, 55% of the population at large should see a benefit of combining resistance training and endurance training.
So you're saying more people as a percentage, population-wise, are going to see a benefit. More people are going to see a benefit doing RT alone versus those who do a combination of resistance training and endurance training?
Correct. And that's as long as the long-term caloric balance is negative.
Right, right. And again, kind of going back to what we said, because, you know, we all, me, you, everyone listening, we kind of hear what we want to hear sometimes.
Correct.
And then, And we're saying, if you're going to say that the RT will impact 67% of the population in a positive way for, you know, weight management,
mm-hmm.
we're looking at those that are willing to work in that 70 to 80% of their one rep max for 6 to 10 repetitions times 3 sets with 60 to 90 seconds rest between sets. And on top of all that, if I don't have anything wrong so far, then on top of that, we're talking about at least a majority or a big part of the exercises being total body exercises.
Correct. And okay. And within a single session, because of all those limitations, you're looking at maybe 6 to 8 total exercises.
Right.
Per
yeah,
session.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And you're looking at three to four times in a 7-day period.
Perfect. Working, you can either work the same body parts depending on intensity, or are you talking about hitting maybe each body part once in 7 days, but splitting the whole body into 3 sessions?
The best way of doing this, because of wanting to maximize the anabolic response here, is to utilize a whole body routine. What a lot of people refer to as being a circuit routine.
Got it. Okay. All right. Awesome. All right. So now.
And so just getting back to the population percentages here, there's another drop in the percent for expectation for benefit when we look at endurance training and diet, where only about 47.5% of the population at large will see a beneficial response from doing either endurance training or strictly diet. The big drop in all of these effectivenesses has to do really with what type of body tissue is going to be either maintained or be lost during the weight loss period. Because the way in which the body loses mass is that it loses it everywhere. You can't say, oh, I'm going to lose just fat mass, unless you're going to go in there and have liposuction. The body is going to lose tissue mass everywhere without reference to any specific type of tissue. And it has to do with a whole bunch of hormone signals that's going to cause changes in the fuel sources that the body is going to utilize, which is why resistance training has the largest percentage for benefit, because it's going to lead to the largest maintenance of fat-free mass.
Yeah, you don't know me, and up until this interview, you know, I don't know you, but at Linus Lifestyle University, we're huge proponents of resistance training. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. As a part from the beginning to the end. We don't just pick a period and say, well, it's time to build some muscle, or I'm going to get some fat off first, or I'm going to get some weight off first, and then I'm going to worry about building muscle. No,
mm-hmm.
it's a part of our recommendations. We don't mandate that anybody do anything. We have solid, strong education, evidence-based, you know, education initiatives that we mm-hmm. that we recommend from the get-go, and RT is definitely one of them. But I thought of this, and I know that, you know, we'll both knock this down in 2 seconds, but I got to say it anyway. Look, if RT is so beneficial, I'm afraid of it because I'm a 40, 50-year-old woman, and I'm afraid I'm going to get too bulky if I do it.
There is no evidence whatsoever for females having excessive bulk. And it has to do with what hormones females have in high circulation that are going to cause tissues to be grown. The principal difference between a male response and a female response to resistance training has to do with the hormones that are being released. For males, the principal hormone that's going to be released is testosterone in combination with growth hormone, whereas for females, the principal hormone that's going to be released is growth hormone. And what those hormones do on the tissues are completely different.
Absolutely. And thank you for, you know, adding some additional science, you know, to why that is the case. You know, if I was to throw it again into layman's terms, I would say that as for a woman, it is I'm not saying it can't happen, but it is incredibly difficult to add substantial muscle ever, let alone in any kind of short period of time. And for all of the reasons you said, you know, and more. So no, they don't need to fear it. So okay.
But on the same point for the female, for mm-hmm. other health issues, doing resistance training is far more beneficial than doing any other type of exercise. And the principal health benefit we're talking about there is bone health.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's so much in agreement. And again, when you're talking about resistance training, I'll just go back and hammer this again.
Sure.
You're not talking about we always have, and if you're one of my students right now and you're the one that's all you have are 5-pound dumbbells at home, great. I'm glad you're doing that versus nothing. It's likely better than nothing, but just barely, because at least you're doing something, and I applaud you for that. However, just for point of clarification, when Professor Clark here is talking about resistance training, we're not talking about that kind. We're not talking about the 5-pound dumbbells. We're talking about the type of resistance training where you are going to work in the 70-80% of your one rep max range for 3 sets of 6 to 10, with 60-90 seconds rest between sets, and a total of maybe 6 to 8 exercises per workout done 3 to 4 times in 7 days. Did I give a synopsis of that about as brief as we can get and stay accurate?
In terms of a brief synopsis, that's correct. But then we also have that second caveat that the person has to remember, and that's the issue of periodization of training.
Where every workout isn't as hard as you can go.
Correct. And not only is every workout not as hard as you can go, but you're gonna change the goal of training over block periods of time.
Mm-hmm.
Where if the person has, once again, we'll talk about the person with the five pound dumbbell, where you start off lifting the 5-pound dumbbell, but then you go to trying to lift it as explosively as possible, trying to move as quickly as possible. Instead of just standing there doing and pressing it over your head, trying to jump and press the dumbbell through the ceiling. And then you do that for a short period of time in terms of a block, and then you go back to doing a different focus so that you change the way in which you're forcing the body to exercise so that you have what's talked about being a continuous adaptation. Because everybody talks about the plateaus within any type of training. The plateaus occur because of either maximal physiological adaptations have taken place, or periodization has not occurred.
Yeah, I love it. And you know, for the people listening, I want to say two things. One, what Professor Clark gave there as an example is just for example purposes, and everybody needs to move within their range of motion limitations and with any, you know, physical disability limitations or injury limitations or whatever you've got going on. And we realize that if you've got a disc issue, if you've got a shoulder issue, if you've got an injury, if you've got something that you are have had to work around, no, we don't want you jumping and trying to press a dumbbell as hard as you can, you know, over your head. However, it was, you know, Professor Carr gave that as an example of this with periodization. I always think of periodization. I mean, I know what periodization is, but when I'm describing it, I always describe it as science-based, organized chaos, where we are undulating and moving and in changing the intensity and changing the volume, and like you said, through these block periods, which for the purposes of this call would just be far too complex to really get into. But just know that what he's saying is, and this is what we see, and I think everybody can relate to this. The average person you see in the gym, they go and they sit down on the vertical bench press machine, and they load up 40 pounds or whatever it is, and they do that for 10 repetitions, And then they go to the next machine, and they load up 30 pounds or whatever it is, and they do that for 10 repetitions, and that's fine. But what happens is, in 2 years, they never change. They do the same exercises with the same repetitions and the same sets in the same order over and over and over and over again. They don't even try to add more weight. They don't even try to add either more repetitions, less repetitions, or different movements and different movement patterns. There's no attempt at that. And they end up looking the same.
That's a very good synopsis, and that's typically how I tend to talk about periodization with the exercise science students that I have. And it's an extremely complex issue that very few people understand to the point where they can apply it by themselves.
Right.
It's where you need to have either an exercise scientist with you or someone who has studied exercise science.
Right. Yeah. And if you were to look at, if our average listener, again, isn't going to have someone who's an exercise scientist standing next to them, but they may have a personal trainer. And if they were to hire a personal trainer, is there a designation that you like, or that you would be that you would feel good about, you know, telling people to put a little more trust in than someone else?
The ones that I tend to have more trust in is not necessarily based off of the certification that they have, but the level of education. Because there's a lot of people who will go get the top of the line certifications, but they basically crammed for the certification exam. There are some certifying bodies out there that are now requiring at least an associate degree level, a 2-year degree level of educational background. The National Strength and Conditioning Association's certifications are actually recognized as being a national certification. The National Academy of Sports Medicine is now in partnership with many 2-year colleges in terms of developing exercise science programs, exercise science curriculum for people who are going to go into personal training. And so, and then you have the American College of Sports Medicine, ACSM, which is basically the gold standard of certification for people looking at cardiovascular and weight management.
Okay. So where do we need to go for our call today and your study with regard to, do you think we're, look, so you're not saying endurance training is no good. You're saying that endurance training by itself is going to be effective in the in the ways you were evaluating. It's going to be effective for about 47% of the population. And if they do a combination of resistance training and endurance training, it's going to be effective for about 55%. And if they do the proper type of resistance training and the proper volume and intensity and everything else alone, then that's going to be effective for about 67% of the population. And if I have those numbers right, are we ready to move into the nutrition part?
Sure.
Okay. I mean, I know that we're leaving stuff out, and we just can't cover everything on an interview like this. But I'm stoked. I mean, I'm already stoked with what you've said, and we are far more in agreement than disagreement. But that wouldn't matter either, because very intelligent people can disagree on things. But I'm loving it. So where do you go next? What would you say about nutrition? What's better? You know, what's a better way to go there?
Well, based off of what we saw with the meta analysis here, is that diet by itself is not as effective as what we like to tout it as being. When you're looking at the dietary aspect, the high protein diets are much more effective than either the strictly hypocaloric, the low calorie diet, or the American Heart Association's low fat diet, and even the American Diabetes Association's glycemic diets. The most benefit from the protein diet appears to be at about 25% of total caloric intake or what equates to being about 1.85 to 2.25 grams per kilogram of body mass.
If I was to take, let's just run, can we run a number on that?
Sure.
So let's just take a 220-pound person.
Okay.
Numbers will make it real nice because they're 100 kilos, right?
Correct.
So 220 pounds, 100-kilo person, and they are going to consume, let's say she is going to consume 1,500 calories.
Mm-hmm.
And she's at 1,500 calories, and with this, we're saying 25% of the intake would be protein.
Correct. That's where you get the maximal amount of benefit. You don't get very much more benefit above that.
Right. Okay. And let's see. So if we do that, so then we've got 1,500 calories times 25%. So 375 calories would be of protein. And so that's about 93 grams of protein.
Correct.
Okay. And 93 grams of protein, if we're looking at how much protein there is on the kilo basis, you know, talk to me about that.
The kilo basis is because there were basically two scales that were used. There was a scale based off of percent of caloric intake, and there was a scale based off of grams per kilogram. The grams per kilogram is going to be slightly higher than the percent by caloric intake.
Okay. So we're looking at the per kilogram on the mass thing. What was the number you gave there? 1.8 to 2.2?
1.85 to 2.25.
So on the low side, we'd be at 1.85 times 100?
Correct.
Okay, so that'd be 185 grams of protein on the low side.
Correct.
And on the high side, we'd be at, my calculator's just...
225.
Yeah, 225. All right, so 185 to 225.
Correct.
So this is just something just...
That's without looking at any type of calorie restriction on that. So
you're saying the 220-pound person in a eucaloric state is going to be at 1.8 to 2.2 pounds or 2.2 grams of protein per kilo of body weight?
When you're looking at the high protein amounts.
Okay.
The 1.85 to 2.25 grams per kilogram is independent of caloric restriction.
Okay, so it means whether they're restricting calories or not.
Correct.
You're at 100. That 220-pound person is 185 to 225 grams of protein per day, whether they are eucaloric, which means they're in caloric balance, or they are hypocaloric, which means they are cutting calories.
Correct.
All right, so 185 to 225.
Correct. Now, for the person that is hypocaloric, the person that is caloric restrictive.
Yeah.
That's where that 25% number comes in.
All right. Now that sounds backwards to me.
It seems backwards, but what we're looking at here is we're looking at it in terms of change. This number that we're looking at right now is strictly based off of changes in body mass.
So, based on any of the protein research I've looked at, you know, over 20 years or whatever, the need for protein increases when we are in a caloric deficit and in other states.
Correct.
Compared to being in, you know, a homeostatic eucaloric state. So,
it's going to take us. Well, once again, those numbers are strictly for body mass.
So, I may have it confused.
Okay, so the numbers that we just talked about were strictly looking at the body mass changes, not looking at body mass components, just strictly benefit of I'm going to lose body mass.
Oh, strictly now, body mass, not necessarily fat free mass versus fat.
Correct.
Got it. Okay, go ahead.
Now, when we look at it in terms of the fat free mass issues and the fat mass issues, now we're going to be in agreement. Because the high protein diet at the 1.85 to 2.25 grams per kilogram is more beneficial for the person to either change fat mass or maintain fat-free mass.
Yeah. I'm with you. Okay, thanks for that distinction. Because,
there's two stories.
I wasn't hearing the body mass.
Yeah,
I wasn't hearing body mass.
There's two stories. The first story was strictly the body mass story.
Yeah.
And then the second story is the fat mass versus fat-free mass.
Yeah. No, totally. I get it. Yeah, that syncs up with anything I've seen in 20 years on protein research. Yeah.
Correct. And there is very little to no additive benefit, meaning there's no additional benefit that the person gets going above that 2.25 number.
Sure. Yeah. Well, here's the thing. Let's talk about this. Let's just get this out because so many people are just, God, they're so, the standard that I've typically used, since, I've been writing about this and teaching this is I'm just going to say this. If you know your fat-free mass, if you know that, typically what I've said is about a gram of protein per pound of fat-free mass.
Correct.
And so versus just, the whole, 220-pound person that's 55-60% fat, having them whatever. But here's what I want to say. So this person who is 220 pounds and is eating 1,500 calories a day, if let's put them at 200 grams of protein because they're 100 kilos, or we'll put them at 2.0.
Okay.
So they're going to be at 200 grams of protein, so that's 800 calories of the 1,500.
Correct.
Now, some people run around like orangutans with their hair on fire, all freaked out, ready to call the cops and everybody else that you can call in freak-out mode about this incredibly ridiculous high protein intake. What's your feeling on 200 grams of protein, but we're on a hypocaloric, we're at 1,500 calories?
If in that case, there's nothing to worry about. The old concern for this was looking at renal functions of the kidneys.
Mm-hmm.
But if you actually look at most of the research on that, there appears to be no issue with the kidneys for the person who is hypocaloric with that level of protein.
The 1.85 to 2.25.
Correct.
Per kilo
of body mass.
Right. Okay. But here's the thing. This is where the orangutans with the hair on fire come out. This is where they want to call the nutrition police on you. Gosh, Professor Clark, that's 53% of total caloric intake is protein. They're going to die. Because there are 200 grams of protein, 800 calories, and it's only 1,500 calories. 800 calories of 1,500, they're going to die. You're causing harm to that person because what they do is they interpret this whole 25% to 30%, which most dietitians and so forth are going to say, don't ever go above 25 or 30% of your intake as protein. But we just said 1.85 to 2.25 is okay. But now I'm at 53% of my intake is protein.
Mm-hmm.
I don't care. I think it's great. I think it's just fine. How do you feel about it?
When you make these changes, what you're basically attempting to do is you're attempting to change some of the metabolics, some of the ways in which the body is going to be utilizing the fuel sources. A lot of times when you have these high protein diets, what you're doing is you're restricting the carbohydrates that you would normally be eating. And so a lot of the orangutan on fire scenario here is
right.
is not understanding what's going to occur within the body when you make these dietary changes. And so, and this goes back to why at that 1.85 to 2.25, we see these drastic changes in the type of body mass that's being lost. And it has to do with the fact that when you are restrictive in your calories, one of the body's natural methods to regulate their fuel sources is to break down proteins. And so by increasing the protein intake that you're having, you minimize how much protein you're actually breaking down to maintain your normal metabolic rates.
Yeah, we don't have to cannibalize skeletal muscle.
Correct.
To come up with our amino acids and proteins when we are consuming them or getting them in from dietary sources.
Correct. Now there is a secondary note that should be made there, is that the people who do go on to a higher protein diet, or what's usually referred to as a ketotic diet, and there's two types of ketotic diets. There's the high fat ketotic diet, and there's the high protein ketotic diet. Regardless of which direction you go, you must, or you should really increase the intake of water.
Sure.
Because of this, multiple changes that occur within metabolism, you increase the risk for dehydration.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, at Linus Lifestyle University, we have as our base, is a half gallon of water a day, and then we typically recommend 8 ounces of additional water for every 20 minutes of sweat-inducing exercise or movement. You know, that's just as our base, is a half gallon right there.
Mm-hmm.
And then we add in for, if you're working out in a hot climate, if you're sweating a lot there, if you're exercising a lot, then we want, you know, eight ounces added for every 20 minutes we're in that. We got to keep hydrated.
And David, this is where the scale can actually become an important tool for the person acutely. If you really want to know how much fluid you should be consuming with your exercise, if you weigh yourself before the exercise and you weigh yourself after the exercise, I'm talking about immediately after,
right,
the weight that you lost is all water. And so you should consume that amount, that volume of water back for the amount of weight that you lost.
Absolutely. It's a great reminder and a great recommendation that we also adhere to. And I think, I don't remember exactly, but I think is a gallon of water about 7 pounds?
Just about, yeah.
Somewhere right in there. So, I mean,
yeah,
if you lose 3 pounds on a run, or if you lose 3 pounds on one of these, you know, total body RT workouts, if you lose 3 pounds, then you need to replace it with about a half a gallon of water.
Mm-hmm. And it's not, and for the people who are listening here, it's not just water by itself. You're also mm-hmm. losing a number of salts. And
right.
that's where the person who is attempting to lose body mass needs to make sure that they are taking salts with either their food or with their water. And that's where the old adage of a pinch of salt per gallon of water comes into play. You don't have to go and spend all the money on all of the fancy electrolyte drinks. A simple pinch of table salt within your gallon of water works just the same.
And on a first things first basis, before we worry ourselves sick over adding the salt to the water, let's make sure that we've got our exercise at the point where we actually sweat. Because that doesn't always happen. Because the exercise intensity, a lot of times, is quite low. But everybody's got to start somewhere. And again, I'm a huge fan of start where you are. You don't have to start off intensely. The habit in the early stages is far more important than the intensity. However, when you're able, ratcheting things up in a sane, medically safe, sound way that doesn't violate anything your physician has told you and doesn't, again, put you in harm's way, we want to get you going, get some sweat going, because as you're hearing from, you know, Professor Clark, you got a number of tremendous benefits that occur when the intensity comes up just enough to change all these hormonal responses. And then, you know, with RT, of course, with resistance training being in there, sparing the loss of muscle, adding new muscle, and all the metabolic and hormonal changes that occur with that. Is there anything that, if we were to summarize things now and kind of at least part ways on our interview for now, that we would be neglecting, that you'd be like, oh man, you can't leave this out. Your listeners need to know this. Is there anything that you can think of?
Well, the biggest thing that we have to remember here is that when we're looking at the exercise program itself, is that it needs to be developed to be self-sustainable and reproducible. And so in that, we have to remember that there is a self-selection that every person has to any type of exercise or activity. And so we need to make sure that when we're choosing exercises, we're choosing exercises that we find psychologically appeasing, things that mm-hmm. we get an immediate psychological reward from, so that it becomes a reproducible event, which means that we don't go and, oh, I'm going to go run with my friend who's a marathoner, and 5 minutes into the run, realize that I'm never going to keep up with my friend who's a marathoner, so I'm going to stop running. We want to pick exercises, and we want to pick patterns, and we want to be around people within those exercise patterns that are going to make us want to continue to do the exercise. And then within those distinct patterns of exercises, we need to remember that the higher level of exercise intensity will provide a better benefit than the lower levels of exercise intensity. And that for people who don't like to do the endurance style exercise, low level stimulation resistance training is as beneficial as doing any type of endurance exercise.
So if I wear a heart rate monitor and mm-hmm. I do lower level resistance training, and but in doing so, I maintain, bear with me, a heart rate average of 70% of my predicted max, and mm-hmm. I do that for 45 minutes to an hour or whatever, mm-hmm. but I've done it with resistance training, you're saying, and the research says, that the cardiovascular benefit, the aerobic benefit, is the same as, you know, getting keeping a heart rate similar but doing a purely aerobic movement?
Correct.
Okay. Okay. Well, that's awesome. Oh, you know what I wanted to ask? I thought of this earlier, and this is out of order, but I just want to ask it. Can you, based on inflammation, because if we go all the way back to the beginning, you talked a lot about inflammation, and I want to make sure mm-hmm. People really have that as a take-home message here. I think that's one of the take-home points is inflammation. There are blood tests that can be done for measuring it, and there are probably other tests that can be done as well. But when we look at that, and I liked how, you know, we kind of work through this whole fitness versus fatness, and you can have somebody that's super capable of physical performance. Let's say we'll use the CrossFit person again, but mm-hmm. they are, you know, the female is 35% body fat. It isn't so much that she's 35% body fat. It may be one that he or she or whatever is working out so intensely with not enough recovery that there are as many inflammatory markers going on as the person who doesn't do anything.
Correct.
And just because they're 32, 35% body fat doesn't mean that they are unhealthy in any way, shape, or form. It depends on what gets measured and what the markers say, if I'm hearing you correctly. But I want to ask, if that's the case, let's take it to an extreme. Can someone be, quote-unquote, fit, weighing 465 pounds?
Hmm.
I mean, if we get the blood measured, urine measured, saliva, whatever we're measuring.
If we're measuring the inflammatory markers,
yes,
and the inflammatory markers come back normal, and we're measuring cardiovascular, because what you remember is that fitness is not just a single measure. There's a multitude of factors going into that fitness measure. Right. If that 465 pound person has within the normal range of blood pressures, within the normal range of kidney functions, within the normal range of
blood sugar, cholesterol,
all of those things, the body mass per se does not make them unhealthy.
Got it. I agree. It's a little tough for me to agree, but I mean, utilizing the science, I do agree. I just wanted to see for you if there was like some cutoff.
That's what the pause was there, because it's a slippery slope on that in terms of what the cutoff happens to be. And that's why when we talk about this fitness fatness issue, we talk about it in terms of a continuum, where the person goes from being the sedentary person to the overfat person to the overfat, the active person to the active person to the active lean person. Because the most healthy out of the whole entire continuum is that active lean person, whereas the least healthy out of all of those is the inactive sedentary person.
Right. Inactive over fat.
Correct.
Right. Right. Yeah, it makes perfect sense. I love that continuum that you shared. Do me a favor and hit that one more time. Hit the continuum from the worst to the best.
Sure. So the worst in terms of the continuum is what we call the inactive person. And that's the person that basically gets up out of bed, sits on the couch, and stares at the TV all day.
What if their body fat isn't too high?
It doesn't matter.
Okay, so just inactive is the worst.
Inactive is the worst. And then with that inactive person, you have the inactive over fat person. So they basically kind of lump together. Then you have what's referred to as the sedentary person. And that's the person that most people within the United States happen to be, which is you get up out of bed, you go sit at the kitchen table and eat breakfast, you go sit in your car and you drive to work, and you sit in front of your computer all day, and then you come home and you sit in front of the television all night, where you have some activity, but it's not enough activity to cause benefit. So that's the sedentary person.
And again, doesn't matter if they're over fat or they're normal fat.
Correct. And then you have on a secondary level, the sedentary overfat, because, and this is where we're going to get a difference in where the continuum goes. The sedentary person will go to being an active person strictly by increasing their level of activity, whereas the sedentary overfat person will then go to becoming what's known as overfat and active. They still have many of the bad health signals, but they're starting to reduce them. Whereas the person that was normal fat, going from sedentary to active, almost immediately starts to reverse their health benefit and becomes very healthy.
Okay.
The person that was over fat may stay in that over fat but active for quite some time. And that's where a lot of people who are trying to lose weight and become healthy start to become discouraged, because there's a long period of time where they're doing a lot of changes but not seeing a lot of benefit. From there, the active fat person becomes what is usually referred to as fit but fat.
Yeah.
They basically will then re-merge with the normal fat person on the activity continuum and will become active, and then at the max become what's usually referred to as lean and active. And the lean and active person is the person that has normal levels of body fat. They're not the bodybuilders in terms of competitive
right.
level of body fat, and they're not the models in terms of being on the covers of magazines levels of body fat. They're normal levels of body fat, because just as having too much body fat can be unhealthy, having too little body fat can be unhealthy as well.
Right. And by too little, we're talking about really low percentages of body fat. Well, let me ask this, because this is just something that I would want to know if I was listening. If being over fat but fit, and not having inflammation markers glaring at us, and again, normal cholesterol, blood sugar, all the stuff's good. All the measurements are good,
mm-hmm.
but we are strictly over fat. Why then is that a little bit left on the continuum compared to fit and healthy fat? Why go ahead.
It has to do with the fact that any reduction in level of activity will cause a faster decline in health status, strictly because of what inflammation signals can come about due to having that excess fat.
So if I'm hearing you correctly, there's an increased risk, even if they haven't manifested into measurable markers that are in a negative light, there is an increased risk if you have a high body fat that they are going to go that way. And if you reduce your exercise or you become sedentary, then your risk goes up even more compared to the person with a healthy body fat.
Correct. It goes into what's referred to in scientific and medical research as what's called relative risk. So what's the likelihood of having a negative outcome?
Got it. Now, what an awesome distinction. Thank you so much for that, because the whole argument of fit and fat has been around for decades, but I'd say even more so in the last 5 to 10 years, it's become more prevalent in discussion. And because we're seeing this trend, and I'm sure you're seeing it too, where you don't have to be at a healthy weight, you don't have to necessarily be at a healthy body fat to be considered fit.
Correct.
And it's not the end-all be-all. And then, of course, as you've heard me mention a couple of times, with CrossFit and things like that, CrossFit's whole motif is it's all about physical performance. As long as you can perform, then there's very little emphasis overall. Not that there's no emphasis, but there's very little emphasis on body composition as long as you can perform.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think the distinction is excellent, because I'm not in any way, shape or form saying that heavy people that can perform in a CrossFit manner are less healthy than, like you said, the sedentary and all that. And I'm not saying they're less healthy at all, but I think having the science behind this continuum and saying that, the relative risk is there. If you are even if you're high performing, the relative risk is there if you are over fat compared to a healthy fat engaged in the same physical performance, or, as you said, how things change when you or if you become sedentary again, when we consider the difference between someone who's over fat versus healthy fat. That I don't think I've ever heard it said that clearly, or I guess that assuredly.
Yeah.
That this is how it is.
And what I think the assurance here comes from what do the numbers say?
Yeah.
And it's what the numbers say. And,
right.
As I was talking with a couple of colleagues of mine earlier in the week, there's a lot of stuff that's out there for marketing purposes alone.
Right.
And so if you cut through the marketing clutter, you start to see the actual forest from the individual tree.
Absolutely. Well, and as I said earlier, and we all, I think we'd all agree, we so often hear what we want to hear. So if we have a high body fat, but we can perform physical movements at a high level, then what we want to hear is we're fine.
Not only are we fine,
we're better than XYZ, ABC, 1, 2, we're better than whatever. Because what we want to hear is being over fat doesn't matter. It just doesn't matter. Why? Because I can physically perform and move in these various planes of motion and intensity and duration and not in strength and all that. Because I can do that, what I want to hear is I'm not only fine, but I'm better than ABC and and XYZ. And and a lot of that is true, but
as long as you keep the activity level high.
Yeah, and even, and like you said, even if the activity level is high and your performance is high, as measured and all that stuff, as long as you actually do get tested.
Correct. And that's the next step in this whole avenue of pursuit is convincing the medical professionals what they should be looking at. Because a lot of times, and a lot of people who are probably listening to this, they go to the doctor, and the first thing they do is stick them on a scale.
Right. Right. Absolutely.
And
well, you got to start somewhere, and I don't disagree with that. But we got to look at the other things too.
And a lot of times, a lot of discussions are based off of very poor analytics.
Oh gosh, yes. And you know, I just thought of something too. I want to make sure that it doesn't sound like I'm picking on. I mean, obviously, my clients, my focus is on helping people that are heavier than they want to be and less fit than they want to be become move toward the healthy body fat, the healthy weight, and the healthy fitness, you know, as a whole. So that's my focus. So I have a bias, you know, toward helping people that are heavy get leaner and feel better and be more fit. But I want to say, too, that just as we all want to hear what we want to hear, the thin person who's sedentary will want to hear that because they're thin, they're fine, and what they're doing doesn't matter. And just as it is for the person who's over fat and exercising versus the person who's thin and not exercising, it does matter. And it isn't, these things aren't, your life isn't occurring in a vacuum. And, and I love what you said, you know, about bottom line is science doesn't care whether you like the information or not. It doesn't care. It is what it is. And if you look at the science for what it is versus what makes us feel good, mm-hmm. or at least lets us keep our head buried in the sand, then you know, I just love where this went. And again, I think it's going to really add tremendous value to the people listening. I've enjoyed it immensely. And is there anything in closing you want to say before we kind of wrap this up?
No, I think we pretty much have touched on everything that we can touch on.
Right.
Without going on for another 2.5 hours.
Yeah, you don't have to. I think if you just put this out, you can just leave your classrooms now and just play this, you know, and for the next couple of weeks for your students there. But no, I really appreciate your time. Thank you so much. I just love the approach that you came at this with, and that you come at your evaluations with. I really appreciate it. I continue to learn. I've learned a lot on this call, and hopefully as things progress and you continue to publish more things, maybe we can talk again. I know I'd certainly enjoy it, and I know my listeners would too.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you so much. Goodbye.
Goodbye.